Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live on this feast day, this Marian feast day, where we celebrate the Mother of God and her Assumption into Heaven. And if you'd like to know more about that, you can learn about what we Catholics believe about Mary and about her Assumption into Heaven. Just visit us at Catholic.com and type in Mary or Feast of the Assumption or the Assumption of Mary, and you will get all kinds of information because we'd like you to know what we believe about Mary and why we celebrate her and why this day is such a beautiful day for us and for the whole world. And I would suggest that even the most committed apologists will almost certainly admit we're unlikely in the extreme to argue the world into friendship with Jesus. And this week or this hour, we explore the vital role of beauty in fully human lives, and especially the role that beauty plays in sharing the faith. Our guest today is Holly Ordway, professor of English and director of the Master of Arts in Apologetics program at Houston Baptist University. Dr. Ordway is well known for her book, Not God's Type, An Atheist Academic Lays Down Her Arms, and now has a new book out that is gaining rave reviews, Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, An Integrated Approach to Defending the Faith. Professor Holly Ordway, thank you for joining us on Catholic Answers Live.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So why can't I just make rational arguments for Christianity and make all the converts that way?
Well, that would be because we're not disembodied brains.
Speak for yourself. No, that okay.
Well, I say this as someone who actually, I'm an intellectual, I'm very head-focused myself in my preferences, and so it's very easy for me to have a tendency to overemphasize the intellectual, which is actually paradoxically why I have become so aware of the need for that holistic approach, because as you mentioned, my conversion story, I was an atheist, became a Christian, and I wouldn't have become a Christian if I didn't become convinced that these arguments, that these claims of the church were actually true. And I would have said all along, oh, yes, I'm purely hard-headed and intellectual. But I would never have listened to those arguments in the first place if it hadn't been for literature and beauty and the arts and personal witness, which got under my skin. And so now as an apologist working, teaching, writing, I've really come to see the need for a truly holistic approach that says, yes, we have our minds, we need to make convincing arguments. It's absolutely necessary. But we also are embodied, we're incarnate, we have emotions, we have an aesthetic sense. So we need to, we have the imagination. It's the center point of my book.
Yeah, yeah. And so do you have a recollection yourself of your early experiences, maybe your formative experiences of beauty and how they affected you?
Well, I can tell you one image that sticks really closely in my mind, which is as a little girl at Christmas time. Now, I was raised purely in a secular household. Wasn't anti-Christian, but it wasn't religious at all. So I never went to church, and in fact never heard the story of Jesus at Christmas even. But I remember that there was a sense of beauty around that season. And one of the images of my childhood that evokes sort of a transcendent beauty for me is that I would lie on my back underneath the Christmas tree, which had colored lights on it, and look up through the inside of the tree. So my whole vision was just filled with these lights and gleaming off of the bulbs. And it was just such a powerful experience of beauty. It got sort of into me, and I would do that, you know, time and again. And it, you know, it's not something you can even put into words. What did that mean? Well, it was beautiful. It was beautiful, and yeah, it connected somehow with that season.
Do you think that experience of beauty, as a child or as an adolescent or whenever we have this, they give us a kind of hint that there's something more to us and there's something more to life? They kind of maybe start to send us on a little bit of quest. What is this all about?
Yes, and that's something I talk about in the book. I talk about the sense of longing, and that's one of the most important things that beauty can do for us. It unsettles us, because if in fact the atheist claim is true, then we're just, you know, bags of meat that can think. Why should we have the sense of being moved by the sight of a butterfly landing in a flower, or the clouds in the sky, or a piece of music? Why, Damon, that doesn't help me reproduce or, you know, feed myself or anything like that. So why should we have this sense of beauty? And what beauty actually does is it's a constant reminder that there's something more. There's another dimension to experience. There's another dimension to reality. And any one of those, chances are, is not going to push someone to say, oh, yes, God exists because I saw this butterfly. It's more the cumulative effect of thinking, how is it possible that there's all this beauty in the world, all this brokenness, which is spoiled beauty? And what does it all mean?
I wonder how much, though, the fact that we have so much access to entertainment may actually kind of push against an experience of beauty. Do you have that sense that the objects we make, whether it's, you know, video or, well, it is increasingly video or music or whatever, these objects are very entertaining and enticing without being beautiful in our world. Do I have the correct sense of that, or am I missing it?
Yes. No, you are very much onto something. And this is something I talk about in a class I teach in HBU's apologetics program. I teach a modern and postmodern culture class. And one of the things that I do in the very beginning of the class is I have my students take a 24-hour media fast. No electronic media, no TV, no radio, no internet, just 24 hours. And it's something I used to do with my undergraduates when I taught English. And it is shocking how surprising and difficult and eye-opening this experience is for my students. And these are Christian students. These are dedicated Christian students who are studying apologetics. I'm realizing how much the cacophony of modern life is really deadening and deafening them. And if it's true for them, it's 10 times, 100 times more true for other people. And I think, actually, that this has a spiritual warfare dimension, because the devil's clever, and he wants us not to notice the world that God has made and the things that God has put for us to see. And if he can't confuse us one way, he'll distract us another way. And I think it's not a coincidence that the rise of this kind of media overload has come with an increasing secularization and an increasing disconnect from the church, from prayer, from an awareness of God. It's very much related, I think.
Do you think that it might create a possibility for really great artists, though, to maybe shock the world with beauty in a way? You know, so you think of the young person who's raised on entertainment and raised on every possible kind of entertainment, that maybe that deadening of the soul that might be the consequence of that might actually be an opportunity for really fine artists.
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things I really hope for is that we will see another revival of great Christian art, because when people are looking, when they're filling their ears with music, when they're filling their eyes with movies and TV and YouTube videos and all that, they're searching for something. They want something. It's like people who snack on junk food all the time. I mean, you're hungry. You're really hungry. And you're trying to fill your need with whatever is at hand. Well, if what you have at hand is just junk food, it's not going to satisfy, but the need is real. And if someone offers you, you know, a delicious home-baked cookie, you know, or a nice, nutritious home-cooked meal, that's going to satisfy a lot more. And I want to emphasize that it's... the media is not itself a bad thing. I mean, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. There's some really great evangelization that's making use of these modes of media. There's great television, there's great films. I watch television, I watch films, music. All of these things are good things as a possible mode. The question is, what are we consuming, and when are we consuming it, and how often are we consuming it? Some things we shouldn't consume at all. Pornography, for instance, this is a huge problem. Some things are fine, but in moderation, like sometimes I watch stupid cat videos, you know, cats, you know, cute cats on YouTube. But, you know, after I've graded a bunch of papers, it can be kind of nice to just, you know, watch some kitten videos. But if I'm spending too much time on the internet watching cat videos, this would be a problem.
Right. Well, it'd have to be an awful lot of cat videos to be a problem because they are awesome. Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, an integrated approach to defending the faith, Professor Holly Ordway's latest book. More on the role of beauty and the role of our imagination in sharing the good news when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking book by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can give to anyone as a starting point for helping them to find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Luke 1:39, Mary visited her cousin Elizabeth, whose baby leapt in her womb at the approach of Mary and the nearness of his salvation within her womb. Elizabeth acknowledged Mary as the mother of her Lord and how honored she was to be visited by her. In the response that has come to be known as her Magnificat, Mary said that there was no reason to congratulate her, since it was all the work of the Lord. Her good fortune lies in the fact that God has noticed one as small as she. God is gracious, especially to the lowly and the poor. It is through such humility that God sent his Son into the world. Today we celebrate the return of this lowly servant to her God. As we celebrate the bodily assumption of Mary into heaven, we acknowledge the sacredness of her mission in giving birth to the Savior and God's determination that she be so blessed. No wonder we honor her so. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Yeah, we got to be more beautiful in the way we go about this. It can't all just be rational. I mean, not to denigrate the fact that questions have answers, and we need to give rational, responsible, reasonable answers to questions when people ask about our faith. But that's not enough. At least that's what we're arguing today with our esteemed guest, Professor Holly Ordway, and her latest book is Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, an Integrated Approach to Defending the Faith. Professor Ordway, something I really immediately like about this book is how it's obvious that you had an experience, almost exactly the experience that I had as a child, which is discovering C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Can you say something about the effect they had on you?
Oh, yes. These books were just tremendously important. They were important for me as a child and had a great deal to do with me becoming a Christian and then with becoming a Catholic. Now, I read these books, read Lewis and Tolkien when I was a little girl. And actually, I don't remember the first time that I read The Lord of the Rings. I only remember rereading it. It's just been part of my life. And I didn't have any idea that the authors were Christians, and I didn't have any idea that there was anything Christian about the books. And this is especially amazing in the case of the Chronicles of Narnia, because, I mean, Aslan is Christ in Narnia, and there are very direct Christian references, but I knew nothing about Christianity, and I never went to church or Sunday school, so I missed them completely. I love these books, just love them, love the world they brought me into. It was a world that really was beautiful, but it also made sense at a really deep level. I wouldn't have been able to articulate it then, but what I can articulate now is that these worlds, Narnia and Middle Earth, they had beauty, but they also recognized brokenness. They recognized that there was sadness, that there was evil, that people failed, got hurt, suffered, and yet it was still meaningful. And so, especially Tolkien, when he presented a happy ending, it actually meant something because it was earned. It wasn't cheap. And that's something that really stuck with me.
And so the Tolkien, well, the Chronicles of Narnia, children can start reading those at a very, very young age. I think that Lewis actually saw the Chronicles of Narnia as a kind of, he may have even used this word, pre-evangelization, that by firing the imagination of children in a certain direction, he wanted to maybe inoculate them against the deadening effects of the modern world, and at least leave maybe a door open so that the gospel could get in later. Is that your impression of what his program was or what his idea was?
Yes. And in fact, he says so very directly in an essay that's called Sometimes Fairy Stories May Say Best What's to Be Said. And he says that he had the idea of writing something that would get past what he called the watchful dragons, that would sneak past the knee-jerk reactions we have. In particular, he was thinking of what he called stained glass Sunday school associations, where people thought, oh, this is boring, this is stupid, I've heard it all before, which actually is a problem we really have in today's culture. It's not that people don't know about Jesus, it's that they think they know about him and they're bored, which is much worse than not knowing about him. So he really thought of the Chronicles of Narnia as a way of getting around that. And he elsewhere says that the Chronicles are all about Christ, and each Chronicle presents an aspect of Christ. And this actually is something that had a great deal to do with how they helped me to become a Christian, because they helped me see, eventually when I realized what they were about as an adult and came back to later, they helped me see that this figure of Christ was much more interesting, much more complex. We see a different aspect of him in each of the books. And actually, I would commend to your readers, if they aren't already aware of it, a wonderful book called Planet Narnia by my colleague Michael Ward. And there's also another book called The Narnia Code that gives a shorter version of it, which really unpacks how it is that Lewis is doing this, how he makes the Chronicles all about Christ in this particular way. It's an amazing work of art that Lewis has done. And I think it behooves us as apologists to kind of understand better, how is he doing it? Because he was subtle. He wasn't heavy-handed. And that is how it is so effective. So that, you know, when I was an adult and I was, looking at the evidence, finally looking at the evidence to become a Christian, and I actually had gotten to the point of accepting intellectually that the resurrection had happened, that this man called Jesus of Nazareth had actually died, was crucified, and rose from the dead. But I couldn't accept it because I just couldn't grasp the meaning of it, that God, I'd at that point accepted that God existed, that the first cause of the universe could become incarnate. Like, what? And I went back and I read Lewis's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it was Aslan, coming back to Aslan, whom I had known as a child, that showed me, if God could become enfleshed, this is what it could be like. I saw that in Aslan. And having seen that in Narnia, then I was able in my own life to say, okay, this idea of the incarnate Son of God has meaning for me now. It's not just an abstract paradoxical concept. I kind of get it, and I could take that step forward.
Right, the imagination has something to assign to it. Real, like it's not just a blank area where reason is just sitting there dumbfounded, going, "I cannot reason my way to this." You have you have imagery, and you have personality, and that you can attach to ideas.
And that's something that I really dig into in the book, because one of the big problems I think that we face in apologetic dialogue is that so often we talk past each other. Even if someone's interested, even if they're willing to listen, we can make these arguments, and we think we're making these great arguments. We are making these great arguments, and yet they don't seem to have any impact. They don't seem to make a difference. And what I think is often the case is that the words that we use, don't have real meaning for our listeners. So we talk about grace, for instance. What does that even mean?
Right, right. And you talk about sin or salvation. It's as if these words have been evacuated of meaning. They're just like a shell of a word. What does that mean to someone to say, well, Jesus offers you salvation?
Yeah, it literally means almost nothing.
Yeah.
It's a Christian-y jargon word. And so, of course, they're not going to respond to that. Oh, yes, I want this thing. What is it? Or right. Jesus will save you from your sins. Well, what does it mean, sin? That's a big question. And so I think a lot of times we get really frustrated. We think people are blowing us off when the fact is that they just literally, through no fault of their own, do not understand the words that we're using in a meaningful way.
Right. They make no. I want to get back to that. I do want, before we move too far away from Lewis, however, you talk about how really quite explicitly Lewis's books are intended to be beautiful books, and I do believe they achieve that, about Christ, so that in the child's imagination and in the adult who encounters them in their imagination, they have access to Christ in a world that really has cut that off in many ways. But Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, for example, is not so explicitly Christian, but in many ways, it's a far more powerful work of literature. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would not say it's more powerful. I think they are both equally powerful, but operating in different ways.
Okay.
I mean, it's like trying to pick your favorite child.
Oh, I can do that. No, so I'm just kidding. Okay. I see what you're saying.
No,
all right.
They work differently. And what we have in Narnia, Lewis is operating in a more explicit mode. He even has Aslan at one point in The Dawn Treader say, "You know me in your world by a different name." He comes really close to giving the key. Although, really, there's so much more that's implicit. There's a lot more that's implicit than I think people realize. That's why I mentioned Planet Narnia as a good book to look into. So there's a lot more that's implicit. But he also does bring it closer to the surface. I mean, there's a resurrection scene in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I mean, this is very clearly pointing towards the Christian story. Tolkien, on the other hand, is very implicit, but it's just a different way of doing the same basic thing. Tolkien himself said about The Lord of the Rings that it is a fundamentally religious and Catholic work,
right,
unconsciously in the drafting, but consciously in the revision. And I think it's very interesting because he actually carefully removed any references to God or anything that could be implied as a religious reference, because he didn't want to present, okay, this is a false religion. This is a, having the characters worship something or somebody would in a way have implied that religion is just something that, you know,
yeah,
is invented.
Right. To me, it is a baffling work because it is, and it's just the most powerfully Catholic thing, but it's hard to say what is so Catholic about it.
Yeah, and that's what's wonderful about it, because in a way, I've read, I don't even know how many times I've read The Lord of the Rings now, but my current book that I'm writing actually is on Tolkien. I'm doing a book on Tolkien and his modern sources, so I am immersed in Tolkien right now and have been for the last several years. And just my admiration grows for his achievement the more that I look at The Lord of the Rings, because it's a Catholic universe is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sacramental universe where things have resonance, things have meaning. And so, for instance, we get Christ, we have Christ figure, but he's refracted through different characters. So we have, for instance, we have Christ, the suffering servant in Frodo and Sam. We have Christ resurrected in Gandalf. We have Christ the King in Aragorn. And all of these figures give us a glimpse of who Christ is coming together and kind of resonating together.
Indeed, yes, they do. You almost want to say, and I wonder, we have to take a quick break. But the one I want to ask you about is we've talked just a little bit about Lewis's technique and Tolkien's technique. But how do we do this now moving forward? How should we think about the task of the Christian artist moving forward in the world now? We'll tackle that with Professor Holly Ordway right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Got questions? Visit us today at Catholic.com.
All people are called to communion with Christ in the church that he founded.
People really gravitate to David Anders and his concern for the callers. That's not just talk. He really means it.
Tom and I are both converts. We've walked that path, and we try to walk it with the listeners at whatever stage of the journey they're on.
It's EWTN's first weekly radio-to-TV talk show, Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders, Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television.
As legend tells it, 500 years ago, a disaffected Augustinian priest nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. The evidence that he actually did this is pretty thin, but Martin Luther's objections to Catholic teachings concerning purgatory and indulgences set off a series of countless ruptures that the Church suffers to this very day. The faithful Catholic wants to be God's instrument in healing these ruptures, but may not know where to begin. Join us this September 28th to 30th as we tackle the topic at Catholic Answers' 4th National Apologetics Conference, the Reunion of All Christians, a lively and inspiring conference designed to ignite and inform your faith. We've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. This is an event you don't want to miss. This is where it all begins. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to leave you wanting more. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Welcome back to this very special edition of Catholic Answers Live. At least we hope you find it very special, because it's a very special day for us as Catholics. The Feast of the Assumption of Mary, and we're very happy to get to spend some of that feast day with you. And also very special because we're talking about beauty. And it's probably something it's almost certainly something we don't talk enough about. As an apologetics organization, Catholic Answers attempts to answer people's questions. But our guest today, Professor Holly Ordway, the author of Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, a magnificent book that I highly recommend to you, is saying to us, it's not just, at least, and you correct me, please, Professor Ordway, if I get this wrong, it's not just enough to answer questions. We have to create works, whether they are whatever works of art or architecture, that actually help the questions arise in other people.
Yes, because we can only answer questions when people ask them. And we need to help people ask better questions as well. It's very important that we'll be able to answer these questions. It's vitally, vitally important. I cannot stress that enough. But as I said, people have to ask those questions in the first place. But also, as we spoke about a little earlier in the show, people also need to be helped to understand our answers. You know, if we give an answer that uses words that they don't really grasp the meaning of,
yes,
grace, sin, resurrection, salvation, it's at this point in our culture, we're not just starting from square one. We're not even starting from square zero. We're starting from square like minus five, where we not only have to help people have meaning for these words, but we have to correct false meanings that they may have for these words. So there's a lot that has to be done that supports our giving answers.
All right. Now, this may be too mechanical a question. I don't know. But let's take a word like salvation, because to me, it is striking that Christianity, the whole Judeo-Christian tradition is about salvation. And the word salvation means, as you said, less than nothing to maybe even the majority of people today. So in what way does the practice of beauty, the use of beauty, reinvigorate such a central idea of Christianity, for example? Is that too mechanical a question?
No, it's actually right at the heart of what I'm trying to do in this book, which is asking these questions. So, for instance, the idea of salvation, we have to step back and say, what is implicit in the idea of salvation? There's salvation from something and salvation for something. Well, salvation from what? Okay, from our sins. Well, what does the word sin mean to most people? Well, it might mean all the fun stuff that Christians don't want us to do.
Nah.
It might mean And on a sort of more positive note, it might mean, you know, doing harmful things to other people, but there's still no sense of an immortal soul in there, because the salvation is only significant if you've got eternity in mind, because otherwise it's not actually salvation. It's, you know, social justice, helping the poor, things like that. So you got to get in then the idea of, well, you have a soul. You have a part of you that is not material, but it's real. Okay, well, then we get into the fact that there actually is a dimension of reality that is not material. So all of a sudden, we're confronting the materials paradigm, that the only things that exist are things that can be touched and measured. And that has to be addressed before we can even get to the idea of sin, or we can get to the idea of salvation, or we can get to the idea of what we're being saved for. You see how we have to kind of back up?
Yes, right. And so we've backed up then. How does art generate that in us, or beauty?
Well, one of the things that art can do really well is to challenge the materialist paradigm. Because art doesn't make any sense if we're just physical beings. Why should listening to a beautiful song change my mood? I mean, you can produce rationalistic arguments for it that only talk about endorphins and, you know, the way the sound waves affect my body or whatnot. But at a certain point, I mean, you can invent an explanation for anything that's not necessarily convincing. At a certain point, you have to say, well, why should this beautiful piece of music or this beautiful work of art or this film have this response in me? And that can't be explained adequately on a purely materialistic worldview. So even just by existing, art puts a little crack in the edifice of materialism and says, well, you know what? Maybe, just maybe, there's something more to this whole reality thing than I thought. And
right.
That little crack can be extremely important.
If I could use, for example, say the person who walks into a great cathedral, and they feel a kind of dislocation that comes over them of, the world isn't what I thought it was, and I'm not what I thought I was. There's something else here. And they may very well not be able to explain at all why that sense of, something is shifted in this space happened to them.
Yes. And this is actually why I make a point of talking about architecture in the last part of my book, because this is, I think, really underrated in Christian apologetics. I think that medieval Christians really grasped, they had a really good sense of integration of mind, body, emotions, imagination, and reason all together. And you see this in the cathedrals, because you really, and I experience this as an atheist, you can't walk into a beautiful medieval cathedral and not be moved. I mean,
yeah.
Really, you just can't. And you might not understand why you're moved. You might rationalize it as the beauty of it, but there's something there that is more significant than just, a beautiful town hall. The medieval architects understood that they were creating a picture of heaven. Everything in the cathedral speaks the same view. They're lifting you up. They're directing your thoughts, your heart, your emotions, your imagination to God, to the communion of saints, to the act of worship, to the attitude of prayer. It's all very intentional. It's not done in words, but it's very intentional, and it communicates very powerfully. And I think you'll find that a lot of people can trace back some sort of awakening or some sort of questioning to that kind of experience. And that, by the way, is why I would really challenge the people who say, oh, at churches wherever Christians meet, well, okay, if you can't meet anywhere else than a beautiful space, then that's better than nothing, for sure. I mean, the ancient Christians met in catacombs when they were being persecuted, but they painted the catacombs as soon as they could. but, you know, we can't just say it doesn't matter, or we could spend that money on, you know, social projects or mission work, because it actually is a form of mission work. It's a form of evangelism.
Right. The cathedral itself evangelizes people in a way that really nothing else can.
Yes. And it helps. It's actually an example par excellence of creating meaning, because everything in Christian art is meaningful. So, for instance, the candles at the altar, they represent the light of Christ. Well, you don't know that until someone tells it to you. But just the image itself, it does resonate in some way. It's fitting. It's right that there should be candles at the altar. It's right that there should be candles that you light to represent your prayers. You wouldn't be able to say why it's right, but it is. And that actually helps generate meaning for things like the idea of lifting up prayer, like the light of the candle, like the incense that comes up from, you know, from the incense, the smoke comes from the incense. It enables you to have meaning for things like, you know, the word of God is the light on my path. We don't get meaning out of, you know, out of thin air. We have to get it from something. And all the art that's in a beautiful church, and it could be a cathedral, it could be a homely parish church that actually attends to statuary and candles and art and things like that. These help people form meaning for these concepts.
Isn't there a way, too, though, that we can become inured to beauty because we think we know how we're supposed to react to it? I'm in a church now. I know how, what I'm supposed to react. I'm in a museum looking at a painting. I know how I'm supposed to react to it. So that we can't ever just say, well, you know, they built Chartres. That's the most beautiful room in the history of the world. Let's just keep building that everywhere, because people, the art has to, and the creation of beauty, it has to keep, it never ends. You can't just say, well, we've done it. We've built something so beautiful, because people will find a way to become inured to it.
Exactly. And so we need two things here. One is we need to help people wake up and see the beauty that's in front of them, so that they don't take it for granted. And this is a process that should happen in every church, in every parish, in every family, in every personal devotional life for single people, to say, okay, am I really seeing things clearly? Am I seeing things rightly? And this is, I think, part of our own growth as Christians. But also we need new artists. We need people who are going to be, you know, in one sense, not reinventing the wheel, because there are some things that we discovered a long time ago are beautiful, like harmonious proportions and certain, you know, the use of color, but you need to put them together in new ways. So for instance, I've been very encouraged by some of the new Catholic architecture. Duncan Strike is a great new Catholic architect. He did the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where I live. And it's beautiful, but it's classic, it's traditional, but it's also new. It's not a pastiche. And this is very encouraging, because we need really talented people finding fresh ways to be beautiful, and doing it well. That's key.
And do we have anyone doing that in literature today?
Well, we do. I actually, it's difficult for me to rattle off lots of examples, because I work mainly with medieval literature and with Tolkien and early 20th century. So my inability to give you a long list of modern authors is not necessarily, you know, reflective of that. But for instance, there's an Anglican poet, Malcolm Guite, who actually is doing wonderful work in the sonnet form. And he has a book called Sounding the Seasons, which is just wonderful. And I use this poetry. He has a set of sonnets on the Stations of the Cross. I use it as devotional reading during Lent. It's just fantastic.
Wow.
Guite, G-U-I-T-E. And he has actually a new book coming out this year called Love, Remember, which I actually have two poems in, which I'm very pleased about.
Oh, congratulations. Oh, how wonderful. Well, I suppose that brings us to the question then of pious art, however, because I'm thinking particularly of Flannery O'Connor and her kind of distinction between actual art and pious art, and that there's a way in which we can want really badly to make objects of art that give glory to God, but wanting to do it is not enough. Intending to do it is not enough. Can you say something about that?
Yes. Now there's good art and there's bad art. There's also, I do want to say a word. There is, for lack of a better word, folk art or folk piety. And I really want to be careful to create space for pious images that might not, for instance, suit my taste, but are meaningful to the people who have them, even though they might not be great art, you know, period.
Right.
They're still actually meaningful and good. What I think we need to fight against, which is always bad, is sentimentality in pious art. Because you can have you can have perfectly fine sort of folk art that's maybe not that well done, but it's not sentimental. And sentimental art is trying to go for the cheap emotional reaction. It's the trying to get you to feel warm fuzzies about Jesus or you know, weepy, sorrowful things about Jesus without actually doing the work of creating that emotion in you through the art. And that, I think, is what we can identify as always being bad art.
I see. Yeah. So that's why something like the Pietà, it is, in fact, it evokes great emotion, but it has no tricks to it. It has no kind of cheap, I'll make Mary look, you know, super, super sad or something, you know, like.
Exactly. It's genuine. And even if you have a somewhat awkwardly done Pietà, which maybe isn't artistically as well done as, you know, Michelangelo, it's still authentic in the sense that it's evoking its emotion sort of in the right way. But forgive me if I, you know, maybe there's somebody who really loves Precious Moments figurines, but I think that's an example of sentimentality. These sort of wide-eyed little children that just sort of are pushing the button of, oh, look at these adorable children and these adorable little praying poses, and they have little cute wings, and I find it nauseating.
Yeah, but it's probably more even common in pop music. Even when pop music attempts to be, give praise to God, that kind of trivializing quality. We do have to take a break, Dr. Ordway. So I will leave you with that, and you can correct me if I'm being overly curmudgeonly about that. Right after the break, we'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines by apologist and speaker Tim Staples is an apologetics tour de force, which delves deeper than ever before into the Catholic Church's teaching on our Blessed Mother. From her Immaculate Conception to the Annunciation, from her title as Mother of God to her perpetual virginity, from her Assumption into Heaven to her role as co-redemptrix, Tim gives you the facts and backs them up with solid biblical evidence in the way only Tim Staples can do. Call 1-888-291-8000, log on to Catholic.com, or visit a good Catholic bookstore in your area and get your copy of Behold Your Mother today. Now available in paperback and as an ebook. Get your copy today.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Again, a very happy and blessed feast day to you. Today is the feast of the Assumption of Mary. And again, if you want to know about what we Catholics mean by and understand the Assumption of Mary to be, just visit us at Catholic.com and just type in Assumption of Mary, and you'll get all kinds of stuff there about what are they talking about, these Catholics. Well, it's right there for you if you have an interest in that. This hour, we are
celebrating the feast day by talking about beauty, none more beautiful than the mother of Jesus. And beauty is not just an add-on, according to our guest this hour, Professor Holly Ordway. Her book, Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, central to the call to evangelize is the call to beauty. You can visit her at hollyordway.com, hollyordway.com. And you also speak at conferences and you go out in the world, right, Professor Ordway?
I do. I do a lot of speaking at churches, conferences, universities have me out to speak, which I love. I love getting a chance to interact with people and doing Q&As and talk to people about what work they're doing to actually use the imagination in apologetics and to see it bear fruit.
And so can they find out information on your speaking at hollyordway.com? It's all there?
Yep. Yeah, I have information on my writing, and then I have a page on my speaking, which actually lists my current speaking calendar, so you could actually see if maybe I'm speaking near you, and also has content information if you'd like to be in touch about maybe bringing me out to wherever you are.
Okay. Apologetics and the Christian Imagination, I want to just keep saying the title of the book, because you talk in there about, well, apologetics is central to what we do here at Catholic Answers. And so this is a really important book to us, a really important topic. And you talk in there about what you call, I believe you actually use this term, imaginative apologetics. And I think I have the order of those words right. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by imaginative apologetics?
Well, I mean an approach to sharing the truth of the faith in a way that makes use of the imagination, because the imagination and the reason are both faculties of the human mind. And in fact, I go into this in much more detail in the book. The imagination is actually part of the way our reason functions. We use it all the time. We don't necessarily realize that we're using our imagination, but we are. And so if we as apologists can understand the role of the imagination in our work, it's going to be much more fruitful. We'll be able to reach people more effectively and answer the questions that they have more meaningfully if we use the imagination.
And would you say that movies, for example, I mean, it's a very powerful medium, but also a very, in many instances, kind of dehumanizing, just in the sense that it's so immersive in a way that it's like a ride. Many of these movies are just like a ride. But do you think movies are a possibility for evangelizing through beauty?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we need great Catholic filmmakers. We need great Christian filmmakers who are going to be creating stories that actually show the world through the Christian vision. Because right now we've basically handed over the entire movie industry to a secular worldview in Hollywood. So they can make good movies, but they're doing it from a perspective where what they believe to be true about reality is not true. They're presenting a perspective on the world that is false much of the time. Now, not all of the time, because any artist who really is trying to do good work is going to be telling the truth, at least in some degree. So, for example, I don't think Clint Eastwood is a Christian. I might be wrong, but I don't think he is. But Gran Torino is one of the most profoundly Christian films I've seen in recent years. I won't spoil it, but it has a really profound Christ moment at the end, and it really brings home what that means. In a movie that he was just being true to his story, to his characters.
Right.
We're not really seeing that in Christian films so much.
And one of the striking things about that is the fact that he's Clint Eastwood and that we expect a certain something from him in all of his movies actually makes that the it makes it work even better when he makes this.
Yes.
Really. It's obviously a Christian. I mean, it's just I don't know about his relationship to Christianity at all, but the message is clearly a Christian message in Gran Torino. Or Mel Gibson in Apocalypto. I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's striking.
I've not.
Another striking film. But clearly Gibson is a Christian, maybe quite possibly a tormented one. I don't know. But this seems to be the general view. But one who intends to make movies that in some way share Christ. And And now I think there are increasing numbers, because of video and all the other, there are increasing numbers of people who are explicitly making Christian movies. They're intending, this is a movie for a Christian audience. What's your view on that, about intending the movie for a Christian audience rather than intending the movie as a depiction of Christ?
Well, honestly, it's usually a disaster. I have to say, my general opinion of Christian movies for Christian audiences is that they're mostly really, at best, subpar, sometimes really dreadfully, painfully bad. And that's because they're not good movies. They're not good films. They're putting the cart before the horse. In order to do a good literary depiction of Christ, you've got to have a good story. When Lewis wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, he was making them all about Christ, but he was a tremendously skilled author with all these books that he'd already written, so much of his life devoted to honing his craft. He didn't just sit down when he was 20 and say, "Woohoo, I'm going to write, this." Although at 20, he was already a pretty good writer. Unfortunately, we see too often in, especially film today, is really well-intentioned people who think that they can just tell a story with a good moral, and they forget about things like production values, acting, script, things like that. Not to mention the temptation to make everything tie up in a neat little bow and not allow any ambiguity or anything like that. Like, there's so many problems that are plaguing Christian films, and also, the kind of Christian literature that is in the Christian fiction section, which is its own little disaster area, because people aren't doing the work. That's the thing. I'm a poet. Previous section, I'm a published poet. And let me tell you, it is hard work to write a good poem. I write primarily sonnets. I've got 10 sonnets in my new book, one for each chapter. And they're only 14 lines. How hard can that be, right? Ha! You would be surprised at how much time, effort, and work. I probably spend more effort on 14 lines of poetry than on 10,000 words of prose.
Right. But then you need a reader who has also done work and is willing to work in order to locate the beauty. Because if you have a reader who's just used to reading, People Magazine, it's going to be very hard for that person to locate the beauty, even in the most magnificent sonnet.
Yeah. And I mean, partly we do, I think sometimes we underestimate people's ability to engage with great literature. I think we sell people short. I really do. And seeing the response to Malcolm Guite's sonnets has really opened my eyes to this. I teach creative writing at HBU, and I try to encourage my students, don't sell people short. People will respond more than you might give them credit for if you give them something that's genuinely good and accessible. But as Christians, we also have a responsibility to help cultivate these tastes. It is true that someone who's been reading, say, Harlequin romances, I'm dating myself, I don't know if these are even published anymore, that person might not be able to pick up Jane Austen's Emma and really enjoy it right away, because it's much more sophisticated, it's much more morally subtle and complex, it's got all these layers to it, and it's much better, but they might not be able to get it right away. And that's why we in the larger Christian community have a real responsibility to support artists, to support them doing good work and not just pat them on the head for good enough work, and to support people in discerning good literature and reading it and watching it and listening to it and really learning how to enjoy it.
I rarely feel as bummed out to hear the music playing. I didn't know that we all. I have a million more questions for you. I hope you will come back, Professor Holly Ordway.
I'd love to.
All right, and her book is Apologetics and the Christian Imagination. You can get it from Emmaus Road Press. Is that right, Emmaus Road Press?
Yes.
And you can visit her at hollyordway.com. More coming up on the Marian option right after this on Catholic Answers Live.